Hi, Backmarket hier. Die mit der Technik, die sich perfekt verschenken lässt. Wie dieser Laptop. Er kann alles, was ein Laptop so kann. Zum Beispiel Black Friday Deals suchen, Preise vergleichen, nervige Werbung wegklicken und weitersuchen. Dabei ist der hier schon bis zu 40% günstiger. Denn er ist nicht neu. Er ist professionell erneuert. Das heißt, von Profis auf Herz und Nieren geprüft. Fitter Akku und 12 Monate Garantie inklusive. So. Jetzt musst du nicht mehr suchen. Das richtige Geschenk. Abgesichert durch das Backmarket-Versprechen.
Manchmal willst du einfach nur ans Meer. Oder durch die Straßen einer lebendigen Stadt schlendern. Oder endlich den Moment genießen. Einfach die Welt mit TUI neu erleben. Mit TUI reist du so, wie du willst. Als Familie, zu zweit oder einfach allein. Flexibel, sicher und immer mit dem guten Gefühl, dass jemand da ist, wenn es drauf ankommt. Gestalte mit TUI Urlaub ganz nach deinen Wünschen. Überall im Reisebüro, auf tui.com und in der App. Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck nicks? What's happening? I'm fucking sick. I guess it was only a matter of time. I mean, it was so weird because just a few days ago, I was like, man, these vitamins I'm taking must really be working because I haven't gotten sick in a while. And then I got sick. I was starting to feel it right before I left. I was only home for a few days. And then I went back out to do Pittsburgh, Cleveland, Detroit. I started to feel scratchy on the Wednesday I left. But it kind of held off. It held off, and I was okay energy-wise through all the shows. But today, I'm fucked. And I don't know what it is. It was a big trip, good shows. But today, A. Whitney Brown is on the show. A. Whitney Brown is on the show. This talk is a doozy because he has become somewhat of a mythic idea, a concept, a mythic, not even presence, but sort of like, what happened to that guy? I was always sort of fascinated with A. Whitney Brown because I used to hear things over the years. Like I used to hear, like he was a writer on SNL from 1985 for a few years. And he developed the Weekend Update segment, The Big Picture, if you remember that. He was one of the original writers on The Daily Show. He worked with us at Air America briefly, just at the launch in 2004, but he was a stand-up. He was from San Francisco, and he was a stand-up. He lives in Austin. I knew he lived in Austin, and I've known that for a while, but he's one of those guys where people are like, whatever happened to A. Whitney Brown? Is he still alive? Where's A. Whitney Brown? I'd hear these bits and pieces of stories about insanity on SNL and drugs, and then I heard some story that he was a busker back in the 70s in San Francisco. It was just this myth filling in, and I didn't have all the pieces. And so I reached out to him in Austin. He came and picked me up. He's got long hair now. He's got a beard. He's got a nice little cowboy-style hat. He lives with his wife, who's an amazing blues guitarist, whose name is Carolyn Wonderland. She's great. So we just go over there, and we're hanging out, and it's like he's like living this kind of Austin, neo-hippie-ish, cowboy-ish, blues music-ish life, and he lays out his story. And I always thought he was brilliant, but it was sort of just the perfect afternoon. We listened to some of his wife's new demos that she was doing with Dave Alvin. We listened to some blues, talking about the comedy, talking about his life starting out in like real juvenile delinquency, you know, being sent to reform school, did some prison time at some point. I mean, it is not what you would think. Because you look at that guy, by the time he hit the mainstream, he did a sort of a clean cut-ish kind of thing. But this is a heavy cat, and it was a real honor to talk to the guy. Also, we lost a couple former WTF guests in the past week. Steve Albini, the great record engineer, music producer, was on episode 650 back in 2015. He died on May 7th at age 61. Oh my God! 61! This is an example of the fleeting empathy of the self-centered, that being me. I'm like, I'm sad. It's so sad Steve died. But I'm 60. Fuck. When is it going to come for me, as my buddy Jerry says. We all got something in the mail. Then filmmaker Roger Corman died. He was on episode 776 in 2017. He died on May 9th at age 98. And I assume that when word gets out, all the trolls will be like, it was the vax. 98, one of the great film producers and directors, one of the great launching pads for some of the most amazing actors of the 60s and 70s. He was a teacher to many and a great filmmaker of, I guess you could call them B-movies, but he churned them out. He ran a machine over there. I'm at Largo in LA tomorrow night, May 14th. I'll still be doing my dates in Vancouver and Seattle in June. I'm in Vancouver on Friday, June 21st at the Vogue Theater. Then I'm in Seattle on Saturday, June 22nd at the Moore Theater. For tickets to those shows, plus my dates this fall and into the new year, you can get all the info on all the dates I rescheduled. Just go to WTFpod.com/tour. So yeah, I'm a little sick, and it was kind of like when I go out on the road, I 3-4 days feels like a month because I'm flying out, I'm renting a car, I'm driving with my opener, Claire O'Kane, and we're doing the shows. But you know, you spend the day. I got to Pittsburgh. I fucking love Pittsburgh. I've said this before. It must have been a couple years ago. I go back and I'm like, yup, I still love Pittsburgh. I just feel like there's something about it. It's a very charming city. It's just beautiful. And it feels livable, and it doesn't feel broken. Maybe it took a slide for a while, but it feels pretty grounded. There's a lot of art. There's a lot of bridges, a lot of water, a lot of beautiful, really fucking old houses. There's the Allegheny Cemetery. Oh, my God. Have you been to the Allegheny Cemetery? You got to go. We took pictures of there's all these mausoleums. It's huge. And there's a lot of these big-ass mausoleum structures. And there's one that I talked about on stage, which I guess is a known thing. It's this giant Egyptian-themed mausoleum. And there are these two sphinxes, one on either side of the steps going up. And it's not clear if they're obviously half animal, half man, and half woman, because this mausoleum and these sphinxes have the most defined boobs that I've ever seen on a statue, like female breasts, and they're detailed, they're nipples, and they're just there in the cemetery. And it's odd, and you cannot not see it, and you can't unsee it because it's so specific. Because, you know, you're kind of passive about that stuff. This is a grave, it's a mausoleum, it's a family plot in the form of a mausoleum, and there are these two sphinxes, and they just have these perfectly shaped and very detailed bare boobs. And I can only assume that after the big guy died, the family was sitting around a table going, look, he wants them. It was his last wish. He wanted the boobs on the sphinxes. And I think if that's what dad wants, look, he drew pictures. We got to do it. I know it seems a little weird, but we got to do it. And so there they are. I don't remember the name on the mausoleum. I think it might be Winter. I don't know, but it's pretty eye-catching. The show was great up there at the old Carnegie Homestead Music Hall or whatever it is. It used to feel more haunted, but now it doesn't feel haunted anymore. Some of these places I've been to many times, and my experience sort of evolves. Maybe maybe the ghosts know me there. Maybe that's what's happened. Uh-oh. Wait. Oh, God, am I going to sneeze? Just make it happen. Make it happen. Oh, God, please. Come on. Oh, it's not doing it. It's not doing it. I've got sneeze blue balls. I'm about to, oh my God. Oh God, just let it happen. Nope. So then we get to Cleveland. I don't really understand Cleveland, but I remember I got a buddy over there, Andy. He's an archivist over at the Rock and Roll Hall, and he had invited me out. So we drove into Cleveland. I called him from the road, and we parked at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame right when we got there, and he brought us into the vaults, and we saw some shit, man. we saw like probably like there's a little too much Bon Jovi stuff in there, but you know, I get it. You know, they're putting something together, but it, you know, I you know, seeing the Bon Jovi hat and the Bon Jovi jacket, I wasn't like, oh yeah. But then he pulls out a box, and in the box is like Buddy Holly's high school diploma. And I'm like, holy shit, that's pretty cool. And then he pulls out the original handwritten lyrics of Highway to Hell by Bon Scott. Somehow that was like, yes, yes. And then he showed us some Otis Redding handwritten lyrics. He showed us some Jimi Hendrix outfits. And then he pulled out John Lennon's kind of a wood grain Epiphone casino that you see him playing all the time in that Let It Be. He played on Let It Be. Oh, here comes a sneeze. Do it. Do it. God damn it. So, oh, fuck. Just let it, just sneeze. So, the casino, we saw that guitar. It's crazy. It was kind of moving, but I'm still kind of hung up on the Highway to Hell lyrics. Look, I don't know. Maybe I'm fucked up. But then Dino told me you got to see Gary Rossington's Les Paul. He's got 59 Les Paul, but that was on display. But then I was like, how about Alan Collins Explorer? He had Alan Collins Explorer. And, you know, I don't know who you are, but when I was a kid, those guys in Skynyrd were pretty fucking cool. So we saw that stuff. We saw the first Marshall amp that was ever in the United States. It was, and that was just like a little bit of it. Hendrix's, I mentioned Hendrix's clothes. That's cool. Some Stevie Wonder stuff, some Al Green's. It's just all kinds of stuff in these massive vaults. And it's emotional. It is like, these are real artifacts that are kind of moving, I got to admit. And then we get to Detroit. And Detroit, you know, we didn't have a lot of time to do stuff during the day. But that night in Detroit, at the show, at the Royal Oak Music Hall, which I, you know, I always thought was the sound was a little bad or a little off. And it was more of a rock club. But this was a good show. And I'm up there for about 5 minutes. And I start doing my Jew stuff. You know, every special, I got to have a Jew chunk. And I hear something yelled from the back. And I'm like, what? I didn't hear that. And then nothing. The entire crowd quiets down. And I'm like, you said something. Say it now. You said it loud and fairly angry and seemingly proud. Say it again. And then this guy goes, fuck you. And it was during the Jew stuff and me saying that I'm a Jew. So I always waited for this to happen one way or the other. And I guess this is probably the best way for it to happen. Just a guy yelling, fuck you. So I said, all right, well, I understand. And so what's going to happen now is you're going to be refunded your money and escorted out of the theater. All right. And then after that, I just tore him a new one and had like some great sort of reactions and thoughts on it. And it was very funny. And the whole show was very funny. It was very engaged. I was at the end of my rope. I was a bit untethered. So it was a lively hour and a half or so. And then at some point I said, look, you know, I can really, what's great is that you are having a good time and that you're seeing a good show. It's an engaged show. It's a funny show. And you're going to go home thinking like, that was a great show. And I'm going to leave this theater terrified and running to my car. But, you know, that's the life of an entertainer, right? Also, empathy is creeping in with the fuck you Jew thing. Because like the guy I found out had bought tickets to the show. He bought good seats. How could he not know what he was getting into? How could he not know that there would be Jew stuff addressed? So I think something just triggered that guy. People are just getting triggered left and right. And they just lose their minds on airplanes and parking lots. It's just people are fucking losing their minds and they're just looking for somewhere to dump that energy. Or he just hates Jews. See, that's the weird empathy balance there. So look. Whitney, A. Whitney Brown. This was really something. And he's got nothing to plug. He's pretty much out of the game. But he is, he's got a great story. And I think I got a lot of it. This is me talking to A. Whitney Brown at his home in Austin, Texas.
Manchmal willst du einfach nur ans Meer. Oder durch die Straßen einer lebendigen Stadt schlendern. Oder endlich den Moment genießen. Einfach die Welt mit TUI neu erleben. Mit TUI reist du so, wie du willst. Als Familie, zu zweit oder einfach allein. Flexibel, sicher und immer mit dem guten Gefühl, dass jemand da ist, wenn es drauf ankommt. Gestalte mit TUI Urlaub ganz nach deinen Wünschen. Überall im Reisebüro, auf tui.com und in der App.
Hi, Backmarket hier. Die mit der Technik, die sich perfekt verschenken lässt. Wie dieser Laptop. Er kann alles, was ein Laptop so kann. Zum Beispiel Black Friday Deals suchen, Preise vergleichen, nervige Werbung wegklicken und weitersuchen. Dabei ist der hier schon bis zu 40% günstiger. Denn er ist nicht neu, er ist professionell erneuert. Das heißt, von Profis auf Herz und Nieren geprüft. Fitter Akku und 12 Monate Garantie inklusive. So, jetzt musst du nicht mehr suchen. Das richtige Geschenk. Abgesichert durch das Backmarket-Versprechen.
Haben Sie das Gefühl, dass Ihre Werbung ins Leere geht? Mit LinkedIn Ads erreichen Sie die richtigen EntscheiderInnen. Gefiltert nach Branche, Firmenname, Karrierestufe, Kenntnissen und... Habe ich schon Jobbezeichnung gesagt? Füllen Sie die Leere und erreichen Sie die Richtigen mit LinkedIn Ads. Investieren Sie 200 Euro in Ihre erste LinkedIn Ads Kampagne und erhalten Sie 200 Euro Guthaben für die nächste. Einfach auf linkedin.com/Aktion. Es gelten die allgemeinen Geschäftsbedingungen.
I'm glad you're alive.
Me too, man. I love being alive. Being alive is the best.
You're one of those guys that at some point you have a conversation. It's like, where is Whitney? Is he alive?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's,
you're like
rumors of my demise.
Many demises.
Yes, I've had a lot of close calls, put it that way. I've had a lot of close calls. But managed to get out of it all.
I was talking to Colleen McGarr last night.
Wow.
She books the Moon Tower Festival. She's still around.
Yeah.
And
wow.
She was telling me about a trip to Florida you had that was pretty dicey.
I don't even remember that. No, I don't even remember. Who is this woman again?
She used to book the West Palm Beach Club.
Oh, yeah. That's right. That's
right. Right? And she was with Hicks at the end.
Oh, yeah.
That's right. Yeah, she said you were down there maybe during SNL and you were pretty dope sick. And she had
Oh, man, wasn't I dope sick? God. Yeah. Well, I did have to spend 4 years doing nothing except caffeine, nicotine, and, I beat it. Actually.
Yeah.
I was depressed for a few years. You know, it's hard kicking dope, but.
A lot of guys, I know guys that they kick the dope, but they're not going to stay. They just need something.
Yeah.
But as long as you're not doing that.
I did nothing for 4 years, and then one I was in a restaurant and I was having sushi and that sake looked really good, so I drank some sake, and I was like, man, why did I ever give this up?
Right, yeah, yeah.
I got a buzz from those little tiny cups. I'm like, man, this is some great stuff. What was I thinking? So, you know, I don't have any addiction problems anymore. I drank tequila.
Yeah,
I love
tequila.
Yeah.
Well, look, man, if you can just stay level, fuck it.
I'm so glad I'm not in show business anymore.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Why?
Well, I like the work, you know?
Yeah.
And I love being around comedians,
yeah,
you know, in the writing rooms. I mean, some of the best times I ever had are with, you know, 8 or 9 guys gang writing.
Yeah.
8 or 9 guys who are, and ladies who are pathologically driven to make their fellows laugh.
Yeah. Right.
Those are great people to be around.
Yeah, yeah.
But most everybody that I know in show business has been thinking about being in show business since they were kids.
Yeah.
It never even occurred to me until I was like five, I was already making a bunch of money at it. I never even thought about it. I finished the 8th grade. That's as far as I went. I think I'm the probably the least formally educated
writer. Where'd you grow up?
Central Michigan.
Like in rural, city Michigan?
Yeah, the rural, small town. Actually, for a while, I lived with my grandma in northern Michigan. We had an outhouse. We had a wood stove. We had kerosene lamps.
And you just quit at 8th grade? And you went...
My family basically fell apart. You know, everyone, one went to a mental institution. One was a drunk, tried to kill him. Anyway, it was a rough childhood. I left with 35 cents.
How old were you?
15.
And where'd you go?
First place I went was Canada. There was a big rock festival there.
What year was this? Like
68?
No shit. So you're 15 and 68, so a lot of shit's happening. The world is changing.
World's changing. And I went to Woodstock. I just lived. You did? The, yeah, oh yeah. I
so
was there.
You went to Canada for what rock show? Who'd you see?
Steppenwolf.
Okay.
And a lot of the same acts that were at Woodstock.
Okay.
Were,
yeah.
Were there. Sly. Uh-huh. Sly. Oh my God, man! In his prime.
Yeah. And did you live in Canada? Were you living on the street? What did you do?
Yeah, I basically lived in the park or, you know, right. wherever. I'd do day jobs and, you know, make money or crash at people's houses. Everybody was hippies, you know. Yeah. It was real easy. I remember when I, going to Toronto, nighttime came and I was still hitchhiking.
Yes.
15 years old, laid, it was summertime. Yeah. Laid down in a field, go to sleep.
Yeah.
Wake up.
And
you know?
And you just followed the rock? You went to Woodstock?
I went to Woodstock, I went to Atlanta, I went to
Dallas. What was Woodstock like?
It was, of course, a lot of psychedelics.
Yeah.
And I used to trip a lot. In fact, LSD saved my life.
How so?
It really did. I was a very angry young man.
Yeah.
You know, for whatever reason. Yeah. You know? And
sounds like there were plenty of reasons.
Yeah. And, mm-hmm. I'm a criminal still, but I was even more, I was a violent criminal back then.
Like, what do you mean?
You know, robbing.
Yeah.
Liquor stores. Yeah. And stealing cars and stuff.
Yeah.
And I was headed for prison. I'd already been in reform school.
When in Michigan?
Yeah.
For what?
I mean, my lifestyle. I had just gotten out of reform school where I spent 2 years. That was the last formal schooling I had, was in reform school. And so I was definitely headed for a bad life.
Yeah.
And I started taking LSD.
Yeah. Like the real stuff. The Owsley stuff.
Yeah, the Owsley stuff.
Yeah.
Orange barrels.
Yeah.
And I took a lot of it.
Yeah.
And I had some, it opened my eyes. It made me realize, man, the universe is Whitney neutral.
Yeah.
You know?
It's not about you?
Not about me, man. And, you know, when the fears come and make you angry, you have to trust in the vibratory waves of love, you know?
Yeah.
And rest yourself in the arms of whatever that love is, whatever you want to call it.
The big frequency.
The big frequency. And it made me a witness to the beauty of this life.
That's exactly what it was supposed to do.
Yeah.
It worked for you.
I've been a witness ever since.
You got the good shit.
Yeah. And I've never stopped taking acid. I still do it.
Just for a tune-up or?
Yeah. Yeah. Although what happens when you get older, your personality becomes very stable.
Yeah.
You really know who you are.
Right.
So it doesn't have the same effect of like shooting you off the planet.
Right.
But it's still a good thing to do.
Just to remind you of the frequency.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that
happened at Woodstock or before?
Oh, before. I was already an asshead before I went to Woodstock. That's why I went. But yeah, I took so much. Oh my God, man. It was a quarter a hit, 25 cents a hit. Hey, look at that, man. You see that thing on my wall there? Oh, I better not say anything about that.
Okay.
That is from the original electric Kool-Aid acid tests.
Oh, it's a sheet?
Yes.
Oh, wild.
It's very degraded.
Yeah.
But it's an art piece.
Yeah.
That's a crime.
They used to have
or to sell.
But they used to have a gallery of acid water art in San Francisco.
Yeah, but that.
That's the real one.
I know because I tested it. But it's very degraded. But
so where
it's an artifact, you know, and it's a piece of art that is a felony to even have or to sell,
yeah,
which I like.
Yeah. And so you're just bouncing around as a teenager.
Yeah. And then I hooked up with this guy who later shot himself in front of me, but I hooked up with him in California.
What?
And
well, how'd you get out to California? You just hitchhiked?
Yeah, I just hitchhiked out there to pick oranges with my uncle.
And you were what, 16, 17?
Yeah, 16. So we picked oranges and
in the valley, Central Valley?
Yeah, yeah, in Porterville.
Yeah.
Valencia's mostly, yeah, but yeah. Picked Naples too.
Yeah.
And then I met this guy. I was hitchhiking and I had just been dropped off at this spot by a female cop had picked me up and I had a roach clip on me.
Yeah.
She took me to jail for paraphernalia and then they tested it and there was no
weed.
It was brand new.
Yeah.
So she drove me back to the spot where she arrested me.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah, it was very nice of her. So I'm waiting there, and this 1939 Plymouth pulls up with the suicide doors.
Yeah.
And there's two guys in there, and they're celebrating one of the guys' birthday out drinking.
Yeah.
So like, come on, man. And that was, there's moments in your life, and I don't know if this is true of everyone's life, but that some random chance event happens, and your entire rest of your life can be traced back to that single event.
Uh-huh.
That was one of them.
The guy getting in that car.
Getting in that car. That car stopping and those doors opening.
Yeah.
The entire rest of my life.
What
my
happened?
Show business career, my daughter, everything.
Where'd you go? Where did they?
We went out to this place called the Jesperson Ranch near Pirates Cove and yeah. Avila Beach.
Yeah.
And he was building this gypsy wagon on the back of an old Bracero truck.
Yeah.
You know, Bracero Transport. It was a 23-foot van with a 235 Chevy in it, very yeah. underpowered. But anyway, he had been a physicist and a champion swimmer, and he was an accomplished classical composer.
This is the guy that shot himself?
Yeah. And he had worked for one of these think tanks, Rand Corporation.
Yeah, Rand, yeah.
And what freaked him out was that they were building computers that could build computers.
Well, that's what we're living in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that freaked him out. He said, I don't want anything to do with this. So he dropped out.
He literally felt like it was evil.
Yeah, he didn't want any part of it.
Yeah.
And he could see something coming.
Yeah.
So he said, I'm just going to go around and turn people onto themselves, you know, if I can. And he was an asset too. So.
Yeah, yeah.
So I had learned how to juggle in jail, one of my many stints in jail in Indiana, actually, Indianapolis.
For what were you in jail that time?
For drugs, of course. But there was a biker in there, Little Satan, from the Iron Horseman out of yeah. Indianapolis, and yeah. he taught me how to juggle. We unraveled our socks
yeah.
and made balls and just to pass the time. So yeah. Little Satan taught me how to juggle. And so I knew how to juggle.
Right.
So he would play the accordion, and then I would stand next to him and juggle, and we would pass the hat, right? We went to Nepenthe and, you know, the Fisherman's Wharf and everything. And it was a bit of a static act. So he had this little puppy dog, Brownie. Ended up having him for 23 years.
Yeah.
And I have always trained animals. You know, ever since I was a kid, I knew how to train dogs. So yeah. I started training him to do all these tricks with hand signals.
Yeah.
And made an act out of it. And then my friend killed himself.
What brought that on?
Depression.
Yeah.
You know, he was depressed. And I think he was gay also.
Yeah.
He in fact, he was gay. So he probably would have died in the first pandemic, the second pandemic.
Maybe. But he couldn't live with it? Or he was,
yeah. He just, you know, mm-hmm. he was always depressed. And also he drank a lot of sugar.
Yeah.
Maybe that had something to do with it. Anyway.
Yeah.
He couldn't take it.
Yeah.
It's something I felt bad about for a really long time.
And you guys were in the act together with the dog.
Yeah.
And that was mostly in San Francisco or?
Just up and down the coast. We
oh,
went
really?
Up to Oregon to the Shakespeare Festival and traveling. And that wagon, we built it together. We finished building that wagon. It was out on this ranch and he's like, I want to build this. So I helped him out, did some welding, and I know how to. I love building stuff.
Yeah.
And we made a stage that folded down.
Yeah.
And so then we worked up a little act and I had never thought of show business, but
right.
hey, I'll juggle and whatever.
It's more of a hippie thing, right?
Yeah.
Just kind of hang
yeah.
out.
And, yeah. No, the first show was over. The first show, I was taking acid and I went up and I just felt like an idiot.
How so can I you juggle on acid?
It's seems easy, like... yeah. But talking to people is hard.
Right.
So I realized I got to put together some kind of a something to
stick
to yeah. stay to people.
Yeah.
So after he died, I went out. I was broke. I went out on the street and I juggled with some jokes
yeah.
and with my trained dog act, and I made a bunch of money. So I kept
just
doing
still
it.
Driving up and down the coast, or
no? I was in living in San Francisco.
So then. You settled down there in what? What was that? 72?
Yeah, 70. No, that would have been 74, probably.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And then my act just got better and better. And then what happened was the San Francisco International Comedy Competition,
yeah,
which was the first one.
Yeah.
It was started by Frank Kidder, rest in peace, a terrible comic.
Yeah.
And John Fox, who was the businessman.
I know, I did two of them. I came in second in 94.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, I was in the first one, the second one, and then I became MC for a bunch of them.
So this John Fox was around then?
No, John Fox came in the third year, and he bought into it to help yeah. Frank Kidder promote it.
Because John and Annie.
John and Annie, yeah.
Yeah.
I worked for him for years. Very.
So this is crazy. So this is 74. You do yeah. the first one. And do you place?
I think the first one was actually, by then it was more like 76 or 77.
Okay.
And I had spent a lot of time on the street first. So Kidder, Frank
Were
Kidder,
you living on the street?
No. I had an apartment. I made a lot of money on the street. We'd make $500 a day.
Like at a Fisherman's Wharf, just doing the thing. Yeah.
Oh, Harry Anderson was a magician there.
On the wharf.
On the wharf. And we had this, the cannery, we had it, we built a stage there. We got the owner of the cannery to build us a little stage.
Yeah.
And then we set up lights so we could work at night. And he was this Russian immigrant, the guy who owned the cannery. He was really awesome. Can't remember his name, but he had been, I think his he had come here a long time ago to the United States. He was in World War II.
Yeah.
Flew the you know, Burma route. He was really, was one of the Flying Tigers. An amazing guy.
So in San Francisco at this time, so when you finally settled down there, in the when did you really lock in 72, 73?
Yeah, 74.
So,
I
what
think.
Was the scene? I mean, like, you weren't at the first Kool Aid Acid. You weren't at the acid.
No. It was. You know, Haight Ashbury had already
kind of crashed, and
yeah. I just lived in the Sunset.
Yeah,
there was a lot going on, you know.
Yeah.
But I felt when I got there that this was a city that would allow me to become the best person I could be.
I think that's certainly comedically that was my feeling too, because I moved there after New York, and this was already in the, you know, the 90s, but like there is a spirit of adventure, you know, like there's freedom of mind.
Yeah
Where you could kind of like, you know, kind of just find your way.
I felt welcomed,
right?
You know, or at least not unwelcome,
right? So you do the comedy festivals. And it's mostly juggling still, or?
Well, there was no comedy festivals right then. I was
comedy
working at
competition.
Like,
I mean,
yeah, I was doing, you know, I was just working on the street, and then I'd do some shopping center openings.
And Harry Anderson was just a guy on the street, another kind of
magician.
Hippie magician.
He was a magician. And Bob Hartman, this great shadow puppeteer. And we would, you know, the one thing that will draw a crowd faster than anything else is the sound of a crowd applauding.
Right.
So we would pass off our crowds.
Right.
And we would have huge crowds. There was balconies with multi-layered. We'd make hundreds of dollars every day.
Yeah.
It was awesome.
And got you out of crime.
I was long out of that, man. Okay. Acid had saved me in the late 60s.
Yeah.
So I was already a fairly decent guy.
And now you're an entertainer.
So Frank Kidder comes down, and this is his first comedy competition. It's at the boarding house. It's like two nights. And he's afraid that he will not be able to keep the audience's attention for 10 comics doing 10 minutes each. So he's like, hey, you know, you guys got an act. You draw hundreds of people. You know, would you come down and be in the competition? We'll put you like fourth.
Yeah.
You can just say you're a contestant.
Yeah.
And we were ringers.
Yeah.
Me and my friend H.P. Lovecraft, another magician. So we got drawn in as ringers. And I started looking at what the comics were doing, and I had already become a little dissatisfied with juggling, even though I had a good comic act.
Yeah.
Because I want to talk to the audience. I want to say something. You know, this is not art. That's craft.
Yeah.
The objects were getting in my way.
Right.
And, you know, so I said, I'm going to become a stand-up. That's something I could, first of all, I could do it while I'm drunk. You can't juggle when you're drunk. But that wasn't the main thing. The main thing was I wanted to connect with the audience in a way that I couldn't with the props.
Right.
And so I started learning how to do it, going to the Holy City Zoo, did five
so
minutes.
So who were those stand-ups in 76?
Jack Marion.
Yeah.
Robin.
Yeah.
I remember I watched Robin work at a warehouse, a communal warehouse for $25.
Yeah.
You know, and doing his routines. They weren't very good. But anyway.
So they were all around, those guys.
It wasn't. Steve Martin was like a big comic then.
Yeah.
He used to play the boarding house and sell it out. But it was coffee houses.
Yeah.
And it was. Not a huge. Now Kidder had come from the Lenny Bruce era, you know, Frank Kidder, the guy who started the comedy
from the old down in the North Beach.
Yeah.
So those guys were still coming in out of town, like Mort Saul, and
that era was over as far as audiences were concerned. They couldn't draw a crowd anymore. But Steve Martin was reviving. That was when he first would do the arrow through the head and all that. It was just kind of a different kind of comedy. But yeah, there wasn't much, but slowly, you know, people would come to see.
Wasn't there a comedy troupe there? Like,
the committee, the improv troupe never got really popular.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, the comedy competition, you could not get people to a show where there's, oh, you're going to see 10 stand-ups doing 10 minutes each. You wouldn't draw anybody.
Yeah.
Make it a competition.
Right.
And suddenly we're going to score them. We're going to, you're going to get a chance to judge.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's human nature. It, you know,
competition.
At heart, we're carnies.
Yeah.
Everybody in show business is a carny. And that's
and,
one of
and
the.
And politics now.
And politics. That's one of the first lessons I learned. So, anyway, watching these stand ups while I was being a ringer for the thing, I want to do this. So I started trying to. I did 5 minutes, and if I had no any idea how bad it was, I would have quit.
Yeah.
But I didn't know how bad it was, so I kept doing it. And just constantly working on new material. And
so you're doing, like, what are the, where are the places you can perform?
Oh, man. The other
zoo.
I didn't really work much at the zoo. The other cafe, because I always wanted money. You know, I mean, if I'm not going to make any money, I don't want to do it.
And the zoo didn't pay?
No, they don't pay.
It was like 12 people could sit in there. I was there at the end.
Yeah, I always have done everything for the money.
Yeah.
But it's weird because everything I've ever done for money, I started out doing for fun.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and this is one of the reasons I'm not in show business anymore. Once I get pretty good at something, I get bored with it.
Yeah.
And I want to do something else. And have you ever experienced, like, you're doing the job that you're getting paid to do, right?
Yeah.
And all you can think about is the thing that you're doing for fun on your time off.
Right.
And finally you're just like, man, I can't fuck this. I can't work anymore. I'm working on this now. And you start a new project. That's me, man, with everything.
But like when you start working at the other cafe and the zoo and and around, like what were the paid gigs?
Sunnyvale,
Roosters,
Rooster Tea Feathers.
Yeah.
Did some old Waldorf, the Punchline.
So this was in the late 70s, early 80s? Or
yeah, late 70s, early 80s, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, 77, 78, 79, there was a whole circuit of clubs in Novato.
So at that
which
point,
John Fox, actually, he was the guy who organized it.
No,
he
I know.
Was,
I knew him. I worked for him.
And
you know?
I
think he's still around.
Most of the gigs were from him. The clubs were just little clubs, $50, $100 a night.
Sure.
At the most.
But you're doing it. You're making the rounds. You're working the act.
And, you know, our format was usually opener, middle, and headliner.
Right.
And Fox started relying on me to do, because I would MC and headline.
Right.
So I would introduce it and, you know, just basically run the show.
Right.
And collect the money. And then, you know, so me and him had a pretty good working relationship. I worked all the time with him.
And then he brought Wills in as a little boy, Jeff Wills. It's probably after you.
Yeah,
it's
long after me. Yeah, never like, heard that.
Yeah, Jeff Wills used to work for the Foxes at the competitions in the 90s. And now he's like the guy at Live Nation. He started.
Wow. Well, I'm trying to think who was around with John.
When was Alex Bennett? When did he show up?
Yeah, he was always there. He was a great DJ, you know. And
he'd do his show?
Yeah, people would do his show. But, you know, Herb Cain, the columnist, would talk about people. And if you're getting Herb Cain with a good joke, man, you know.
And then when did you feel it become a thing? Like people were like into the comedy?
Oh, man, that. When they really, you know, hard laughter that hurts your stomach is actually physically addicting.
Yeah.
So people started coming to the club. They didn't really even know.
But I think it felt like San Francisco. Like there was sort of an excitement around what's going to happen. You weren't a riff guy, were you? I mean, like, you know, it seems like that style that Robin created and that went through Pearl and Warren Thomas.
I never liked Robin's comedy. I'll be honest with you.
Yeah.
It's disjointed. He's not making a point.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I remember one time I was doing a show with him at the Great American Music Hall.
Right.
And he ended his show. He did all this, you know, alleged improv, although it's all pretty set stuff, you know. And then he ended it with like this something anti-war thing on his knees, praying to God or something like that. Came off stage. I looked at him. I said, Robin, how do you live with yourself? And he just looked at me and said, hey, it worked for Jolson. So Robin was a super nice guy. But,
smart guy, though.
Oh, yeah. Very smart guy. Absolutely.
And anyway, what were you doing?
I was trying to do, my hero was Mark Twain.
Right.
Now, Mark Twain was a stand-up comic.
Yeah.
Only they called it lecturing back then.
Yeah.
And, man, if you read his autobiography, there's some deep stuff in there about stand-up. he compares side by side two stories, one for print and one for speech.
Yeah.
Which is extremely educational for a writer.
Yeah.
Anyway, Mark Twain, W.C. Fields was, he made me laugh harder than anyone. I still used to use one of his jokes.
Oh, yeah?
Metaphors. They just come to me like something comes to something or other. That's Fields, man. And he was a juggler, as you know.
Yeah.
And that's how I juggle. I took his style, which is very small. It's not like rings and, you know.
Right.
It's like really small right in front of you with comic moves.
Right.
It's a unique type of juggling that Fields kind of invented.
And you can kind of do one-liners in between.
And also you're pretending the balls are trying to escape. It's right. All like right between your chin right. And your belly button.
Right, like close-up magic.
Yeah, it's a great style, and it requires a lot of practice. I used to practice 10 hours a day. But anyway, getting back to stand-up comedy. Yeah, Twain. And then I went to see Richard Pryor, I think probably 79, at the Circle Star Theater in San Carlos. And it just blew me away.
Really?
Because the idea that you could take that kind of pain and turn it into laughter, the kind and the absolute something that's always fascinated me is the casual brutality of life on Earth.
Yeah.
The absolute casual brutality of it.
Day to day.
For every creature alive.
Yeah.
And to respond to that with laughter.
Right.
And to turn that into laughter. I did used to spin on the Tonight Show that kind of summarized that. But that to me, and
what
that's what
it?
Prior to it was about, it's a long Shaggy Dog story about a dog that got
a literal smashed, Shaggy Dog story.
Yeah, got smashed by some watermelon and this lady that was. Anyway.
And you did that for Carson?
Yeah, I did that for Carson. This is my first Carson show. Phyllis Diller sent me a telegram afterwards saying that's a very high-level comedy. That's what she said.
Well, that's interesting to me that, like, because, you know, I kind of cite, you know, Pryor as being an inspiration because of the humanity of, you know, where you're coming from.
The ability to turn pain into laughter, to laugh at, you know, dignity.
Yeah.
To be able to endure this life with dignity, you know, you're going to be brutalized.
Right.
You're going to be oppressed.
Just by time.
By all of it, yes. By time, by disease, by other people, depending on where you live.
Right.
And, but you don't have to let it take your dignity. You can laugh at it. Look at Navalny, man. That's such a perfect example.
Yeah.
Putin never took his dignity. He took his life,
right?
But not his dignity. And that there's something very profound about that. Something to strive for.
So the combination between the humanity of Pryor and the sort of kind of interesting, you know, moral universe that Twain occupied, like he was able to sort of see.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Were you like were you a Mencken guy? H.L. Mencken?
Not really.
Yeah.
It's a little too urban for me, but
yeah.
But I uncovered something about Mark Twain that I don't think anyone who, even all the scholars, have figured out. His first book, Innocents Abroad, it's a story of his trip around the Holy Land and through the Grand Tour, the Mediterranean. Have you ever read Herodotus?
I don't know.
Herodotus is called the father of history.
Right.
The Greeks know him as a comic father of history,
right?
But most people don't know how humorous it is. But if once you unlock his sense of humor, you can see that he's a humorist. And Twain knew that, and the first book, Innocents Abroad, is basically a copy of
Herodotus. Yeah,
same places, does the same things. So I think that Twain got his style from Herodotus,
right?
You know, I mean, Herodotus, you don't recognize it as jokes when you're reading it. Like, well, I won't go into an example.
Well, sometimes jokes are relative to the time.
Yeah, but some of them, oh, man, that was 2,500 years ago, and he's talking about this rebel group in the island of Lydia, and he says these rebels rebelled against the government, so they were exiled. So they this is the story of these guys. They went to Sparta to ask for aid.
Yeah.
That's the first joke. The Spartans were extremely stingy.
Yeah.
So they go before the Spartan magistrates, right, to ask for aid. And as Herodotus puts it, they gave a lengthy speech, as people who are in need of aid are liable to do. And you know the Spartans, the word laconic, Laconia is where the Spartans live, means, I don't know, stingy with words.
Right.
So they were Laconians. So they considered the speech, the Spartan magistrates, and their reply to the rebels was, "Your speech was so long that we forgot the first half. Therefore, the second half didn't make any sense. We are judging you to be insane as a result, and we're going to put you to death tomorrow." So they go, wait, let us come back and try again. We'll give you a speech tomorrow. So they come back the next day, and they hold up an empty wheat bag, right? Empty grain bag, and they say, "The bag needs wheat." And then they sit down.
Yeah.
The Spartans considered it, and they said, "There was no need for you to have said the bag." And they put them to death. So the book is full of stuff like that that you don't really understand as a joke until you unlock that key.
Right.
And that's what Mark Twain did. And so I caught him, his influence, which was really satisfying. But anyway, Richard Pryor was the one who made me realize that stand-up is an art. It can be, it's not just entertainment. It can be raised to the level of any of the highest arts.
Yeah.
Whether it's painting or music. It's rare, of course. Most of the time, it's just entertainment, but it has the potential to turn pain into something universally true.
And also to change, if you have a point of view about something that no one noticed before through a turn, it can change the way they perceive the world. Not just their pain, but the pain element of it is the foundation of making people feel less alone in their own pain.
Well, I don't know if it can do that. I mean that can happen with anything. But the thing that the stand-up can do, there's a communication between the stand-up and the audience.
Right.
But that really is, when you think about it, the least of what's happening in that room. It's a very tiny part of the communication that's happening in that room.
Just the connection.
Yeah. The real communication is the audience with each other.
Yeah.
That's what's really happening.
Right. Well, that's the less alone business.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what's really happening. The audience is communicating with each other. And they're learning every time you say something, "Oh, we all think that was funny,"
right,
or "None of us think that was funny," or "We all thought that was over the line," or "We all have thought that way," or "Oh, that's something that we all understand." And that's the audience getting to know each other, and that's what's really going on in a stand-up room. It's almost, the person on stage is just facilitating that, but that's the real thing that's happening. And once you understand it's not about you, even though you're the guy on stage, and I think a lot of comics never get that. They never understand. It's not about you. It's about them. But that's
the dichotomy, though, that you're talking about. Either you're an entertainer or you're a communicator. You're there for a deeper purpose.
One of the things that's really boring about show business is the showbiz syndrome, and I see this. So it's the idea that if you can get enough strangers to applaud or love you, that you'll fill that hole or whatever. And the flaw in that reasoning, of course, is that the one person that can make you feel a whole is never in the audience.
Yeah.
It's the one on stage.
Yeah, in you.
Exactly. You're on.
Good luck.
I don't care how big your audiences get. That person that's going to make you feel like you want to feel is not in it.
How long are you out there? Are you doing the road in the 80s?
Yeah, I used to do 5 weeks out of six on the road. And
clubs?
Clubs. Oh, yeah. Yeah, the cocaine days.
Yeah.
I had this connect in Key West. And he would send it to me wherever I was. Yeah, it was, yeah.
So, okay, so then how do you get, when do you get your first Tonight Show break?
Oh, man, it's a long story, but okay, so I wanted to do the Tonight Show, and because back then it made a difference.
Yeah,
it doesn't now. But so Robin had these managers,
Shapiro.
No, Bresner.
Oh yeah.
Uh, Rollins and Joffrey.
Okay, yeah, yeah, sure.
Rollins, they're both dead now, but Larry Bresner was their underling. And yeah. David Steinberg.
Steinberg, that's who I meant. David Steinberg, yeah.
What a little life. But anyway, he called me over to his house once because he had rats under his bed. Under his bed.
Steinberg.
Yes.
Yeah.
Can you imagine the kind of karma you have to have a family of rats living under your bed?
What do you want from you?
I was like, I'm a rat killer, man. I said, block up all the doors, you know, put towels under them so they can't escape, and I'm going to flip that over, give me a stick, and I'll kill them all.
You were a known rat killer at this time. Or you were just a go-to guy.
Go-to guys. Can you help me? Yeah, man, I'll kill those rats for you. I have very fast reflexes when it comes to rats.
So in return for the rat-killing favor, he got you the Tonight Show?
No. Actually, he tried to ban me from showbiz eventually.
Why?
Some shit that happened at Saturday Night Live. But anyway, the way I got Rollins and Joffrey to represent me,
yeah,
I had a really good, by then I was really a pretty good comic. You know?
Yeah.
I had some meaningful stuff. Some geopolitics.
Yeah.
And some good stuff. Some of it was family, you know, and just stories. Some of it was politics. So I had a tape of it, but they never look at tapes. You know, you try and get Jim McCauley to look at your tape, and he's like, "I got hundreds of these." That's what he told me. He said, "I have hundreds of these on my desk. I'm not going to get around." So how did I do that with Bresner? I sent him a tape, and then I called him when I knew he wasn't going to be in, and said, "Okay." I tricked him into watching it.
Yeah.
Can't remember exactly how.
Yeah.
Making him say he'd already watched it, and then when he hadn't, and you know, I'm coming down, and blah, blah. I don't remember how exactly I did it, but somehow I finagled him into watching the tape, and it blew him away, and he said, "We'll get you on Tonight Show right away."
Yeah.
And went to the Comedy Store, and Good Omen, it bombed. Totally bombed, which is a great omen.
Yeah.
McCauley was there. He's like, "Okay, you know, but it's good enough." So
he said it was good enough.
Yeah. It was pretty well. Rollins and Joffrey had a lot of juice.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So I went on, and it was great. It's great that when it bombs in the night before. But if you watch that first Tonight Show, Johnny is really backs off. He's like, "Here's a, you know, a comic that
wasn't sure about you."
Yeah, yeah. Well, he doesn't attach himself to it.
Right.
He doesn't endorse it. He's like, "You're gonna go." He's very smart that way.
Yeah.
And I killed, of course. And then he was like, "You know, this is his pre. You know, I'm his first. Yeah. This is his first network appearance."
Yeah, sure. But he waited till after.
Yeah, and then after that, he spoke very highly of me. I think I did his show 7 times.
Yeah.
And I could have done it more, but I don't think you should go on and do something unless you really have something to say.
Sure.
You know, so just to go on and to go on, like I think Steve Martin went on 100 times. You can't have that much to say. So to me, it was like, if you kill, people remember you. If you just do okay, you might as well have not done it.
But the intention was to get more road attention, you know, to sell more tickets?
No, the intention was, you know, they were going to try and do the Robin thing, get in movies, get in TV and all that. So... Al Franken, I did this thing about politics, you know, about geopolitics. What happened was, remember when Russia invaded Afghanistan? This was when that happened. And Johnny Carson came out and did a bit on it. And his punchline was that he pulled his pants down and on the back of his underwear was written, "Russia sucks." And I was so embarrassed as an American by that. That it was truly offensive to me to think that that's what people see America. That's the kind of thoughtful geopolitical, you know, I mean, that's not us, you know?
Yeah.
And so I took some acid with Warren Spotswood. Remember him?
Kinda,
anyway, great comic from Mobile, Alabama. And we worked out an intelligent geopolitical response, comic routine with lots of jokes, but it was truthful.
Yeah.
And it was about the neighborhood that Russia lives in and what's going on around it. So, and Afghanistan. And I actually went on Tonight Show and did it.
Yeah.
And that, to me, was very satisfying to see something on television, major show, be embarrassed by it, and be able to do a response and say, this is another side of
it. Did you present it like that? Or you just did
No, I just did it.
Right.
You know, but in my mind, I mean, I'm able to, I have that forum.
Yeah.
I could actually, correct people's impression. Yeah, they were very unsure about it.
Yeah.
They were like, okay. And I was like, no, this will work, believe me. And it did. It worked great.
Okay.
And that was my first entree. Before that, I'd just done stories about dogs and kids and stuff.
Because
I thought that was more universal and more long-lasting.
Yeah.
But as it turns out, current events is long-lasting. It you know, stands up.
Right.
So Al Franken, this was in 1984. They were, Lorne
was out.
Lorne was just, they were trying to get him to come back into Saturday Night Live. It was a big risk for Lorne to come back. You know, they had lost, you know, he had been out for 5 years, and that year, Eddie Murphy had quit, Joe Piscopo, Billy Crystal, they were all gone.
Yeah.
There was nobody left. And they were going to cancel the show unless Lorne would come back. But Lorne had had the show, the new show, that had more or less kind of bombed. So it was
Which one was that?
It was a show he made called The New Show, but it didn't work.
I don't even remember.
Yeah, of course. It failed. So for Lorne to come back and do Saturday Night Live, if he failed again,
yeah,
that would be bad. It was a big risk that Lorne took.
Yeah.
Actually, I don't think people realize how big a risk Lorne took coming back to shepherd the show, because they were going to cancel it unless Lorne came back. I think coming back, Lorne was a little apprehensive, I think, because a failure would be very bad for him. And I don't think he really knew what it was that had made the show a hit.
Yeah.
You know, they're hiring him back to bring his magic touch, but he didn't know what the magic touch was.
Yeah.
Understandable.
Right.
So he basically put Franken and Downey as front producers. In other words, if anything happened, it's on them.
Head writers?
No, they were producers.
Okay.
Yeah. They were producers.
So he set himself up to blame.
To be able to have some front. And Lorne is very loyal that way. He explained it to me like this. I'm the flag. You know, you don't let the flag touch the ground, and the flag will take care of you.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, he'd hire them back at a higher salary. If they failed, they'd take the blame, and he'd hire them back at a higher salary. Anyway, so that's how Lorne, he's very loyal that way. And so Franken, they were looking around for new cast members, and Franken saw me and wanted me to become a writer. I had never written for television before, but he contacted Rollins and Joffe. I didn't even know about this. One day, Steinberg comes in and says, oh, you know, Saturday Night Live wants you to come and be a writer. But we turned him down 3 times. And I'm like, what the fuck? I want to be a writer. That's what I want to do. I don't want to be a performer. I want to be a writer. And so over their objections, you know, they were holding out for me to be a cast member. I can't fucking act.
Yeah.
You know, so I wouldn't enjoy it, even if I could. So I got hired, you know, Franken hired me as a writer. And right from the very beginning, I had an act for it. You know, the first thing we did in August was start writing promos for the return of the show. And, you know, I wrote some great ones. And eventually I got in charge of writing all the promos for 5 years, because other writers, they had it in their contracts. We do not have to write promos.
Yeah.
But anyway, so after about 3 months there, they started asking me to go on camera, do an update thing.
Who was hosting update then?
Dennis Miller.
Yeah.
And Dennis, anyway.
What?
Can't write a joke. He doesn't really even recognize a good joke.
Yeah.
Herb Sargent wrote most of those.
Yeah.
But, you know, I like to, I don't want to badmouth anybody.
Yeah.
Although I do enjoy doing it.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you look at, you can deconstruct comedy. Like, I met, what's his name? The guy that does You're a Redneck?
Oh, yeah, Foxworthy.
Jeff Foxworthy. Asked me to write a couple jokes for him. So I did. I wrote
before the Redneck thing or during the Redneck?
During the Redneck thing. This was my joke. If you're poor, white, and not very well educated, you might be a redneck.
The joke to end his act.
That's the joke.
Yeah. Yeah.
But when you deconstruct Miller's act, his whole act is basically about him trying to convince you that he's smarter than
you. Right. Yeah.
And that's what it's about him. Again, it's not about the audience.
So you get the shot to do on camera? How's that?
Yeah, they asked me to do it, and I'm like, ah. So I didn't know what to do. You know, they said, write something about geopolitics. We really need that. And so I couldn't think of anything. Now, Mark McKinney, Kids in the Hall.
Yeah.
Saw him last month. He's an awesome guy.
Yeah.
Been to Austin a couple times, too. Love that guy. His father, he's a Canadian.
Yeah.
His father was a Canadian diplomat.
Yeah.
So he it was steeped in, you know, world affairs.
Yeah.
So me and him, one cold January afternoon, we took some acid in Central Park in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
And it was a fresh snowfall. God, that was a beautiful night.
Yeah.
And we came up with the big picture.
Your bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
a context.
Yeah, the context of it. We wanted to name it something that sounded like you'd already heard it before.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not very original name, but something. Oh, yeah, that. So yeah. Everyone goes, oh, yeah, I know that.
Yeah.
And so I think I did about 70 of those.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what kind of defines you as on SNL and also culturally.
Yeah, and everyone thought, you know, this guy's obviously some Harvard-educated guy or professor.
Eighth grade, buddy.
Eighth grade, man. Yeah, absolutely.
Eighth grade, Mark Twain and acid. And yeah. A little bit of Pryor.
I know. It was like, you know, reviews were like, you know, this guy's whatever. Anyway, it was pretty funny.
So how crazy was it at SNL during your year?
Well, look, man, I would get to write my piece usually after my other duties were finished.
Writing other stuff.
Yeah, because I wrote a lot of liar sketches and, you know.
Was Chris Farley on the show then?
He was for the last couple of years I was there, yeah.
You guys were friends?
Yeah. I have some big regrets about that.
In terms of how he ended up?
Yeah, because, you know, he followed me and GE, another guy on the show to find his first heroin.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
We used to go down on
Alphabet City?
9th Avenue.
Yeah.
There was a spot there.
Yeah.
We'd do it between dress and air, a couple of the people.
But was that your first time with that shit?
Yeah, I just took it to take the edge off. The
yeah,
I couldn't have done Saturday Night Live without the drugs.
Yeah,
I had too much anxiety.
Yeah,
you know,
mostly blow.
I just
combo.
The pressure. Yeah, I couldn't have done it without the drugs.
Yeah.
So yeah, they took their toll, almost killed me. But that's the price you pay.
And you feel a little bad about leading a little Chris astray.
Yeah, but there's a supernatural story about Farley.
Yeah,
that I think is. It needs to be told. He was this guy. Oh, that's my neighbor. There was this guy in Wisconsin, not very well educated, overweight, no friends.
Yeah.
And he decided that he would live his life as a copy of John Belushi. That was what he was going to do.
Yeah.
He's in this little town, you know, with a bunch of buddies, working class. And he did it.
Yeah.
He did it. Now, like, one small part of his plan was to become a star on Saturday Night Live. That's not easy.
Yeah.
That's not an easy thing to do. And then he did it. He lived his whole entire life. That was all he couldn't think of anything. It's almost supernatural because he did it.
Yeah.
He actually did it and died, did the whole thing.
Yeah.
Lived the life that he saw that and he went, I'll do that.
Yeah.
And he wasn't very smart. He wasn't very competent. He wasn't.
He was funny, though.
He was funny. Yeah, he was.
I know a guy told me a story about Farley once and they were partying and they were on mushrooms and it was late at night and they were at this guy's apartment and Farley just, you know, threw up on himself. And he looked at the guy and goes, I guess I'm full.
Yeah. But it is funny to us. But I went to, you know, I'd go over to pick him up at his apartment sometimes. Yeah. And I mean, he lived in this one room and he'd never even turned his kitchen sink on. He used his bathtub sink for everything. He had like one T-shirt. I mean, he was a husk of a human. Anyway, the story is because he couldn't be anyone, he decided to be this guy.
Yeah.
And he did.
It's a little sad.
It's not just sad, but it's also unbelievable that he did it.
And so you were there with Sandler and all those guys?
Sandler last year shared an office with Chris Rock his first 2 years. But my first cast was the 11th season. Robert Downey Jr., Randy Quaid, Joan Cusack. And that is the season although we got terrible reviews, we did have some hits.
Yeah.
The Liar, which I wrote, and John Lovitz came up with the character, and I wrote the scripts. Master Thespian, Lovitz basically saved the show for another 39 years. That was the hinge. That show, if we hadn't had a couple of hits on that show, there would be no, Saturday Night Live would have ended right then. So what happened was, to continue with the story about Lorne taking this big risk, and he stocked the cast with movie stars.
Yeah.
Hopefully, Anthony Michael Hall, Robert Downey Jr. And none of them were very good at sketches.
Right.
But I think what he had, Lovitz, who, was great. He had...
Hartman or no?
No.
Yeah.
So... At the end of that season, with the fire, and everything, we had also had great hosts. We had Madonna. We had Francis Ford Coppola as guest director. And that show got panned, but it was, can you imagine staying up all night writing with Francis Ford Coppola?
Yeah.
That's something I got to do.
Oh, that's great.
And, but anyway, so at the end of that, almost everybody got fired except for me and Lovitz. And I think he kept Dennis. And, but it was the writers that saved that show. George Meyer.
Yeah.
All those Simpsons. He branded the Simpsons. All the best Simpsons are George Meyer. John Swartzwelder, who a lot of people don't think is a real person. You say, I'm a myth. Swartzwelder is really, there's a statue of him in the town of Springfield in the opening credits. Jedediah Springfield, that's John Swartzwelder.
Yeah.
That's how big an impact he had on that show.
Yeah.
He lives in Roy Rogers' old house now, and he's kind of a recluse, but
he's
a real person.
Funny guy.
An interesting guy.
Yeah.
But a very precise comedy writer.
Yeah.
But he's retired too. But we had Robert Smigel.
Yeah.
We had Carol Leifer. We had Franken and Downey and Davis, Don DeVello. And Don DeVello, as a comedy writer, he would present, he would write something. I mean, like, imagine reading the cheeseburger sketch at Read Through, and people are like, what's funny about that?
Yeah.
And then it's a national hit. He wrote this very, very soft kind of comedy that you couldn't see why it was funny, but yet
if it played,
it
well,
worked. Yeah. And Jack Handy, I think, was there that year. I mean, we had an incredible group of writers that all have gone on to have great careers. So at the end of it, Lorne, I think, figured out that what made the show work performance-wise, the magic that inhabited the first few seasons, was people who had worked together for a long time. Harvard Lampoon, all that stuff. People who knew each other and worked together. That was part of it. So he went and he asked people, who do you want to work with, And Lovitz said Hartman, my friend Phil Hartman. And Dana had auditioned, I think, and I said, Dana, I came up with him at the other cafe. Nora Dunn came up with her at the other. We'd all worked together many, many times in stand-up situations.
In San Francisco.
And then they asked Dana, who do you want? He goes, oh, my buddy Kevin Nealon from San Francisco. And then they asked Kevin, who do you want to work with? Oh, my girlfriend, Jan Hooks from San Francisco. So that was the cast that made the second Golden Age.
Yeah, because everyone knew each other.
Yeah, Lorne fired everybody, and just the people who had done well, he said, who do you want?
Yeah.
And that's how that happened.
Wow.
And we did really create the second golden age of that show.
Yeah.
Man, the last show I saw was really good with...
Gosling?
Yeah, Gosling. Yeah. It was great.
It's funny.
A good show.
Very it was, show. Yeah.
Yeah.
So how did it end there for you?
Addiction. I was not really competent anymore. I was like, I was a mess,
With the dope?
With the dope, and I was like...
What was the thing you wanted to clear up with Dana?
Oh, yeah, okay, so I got to correct the record on this thing with Dana Carvey.
Yeah.
Because Dana told the story about me and Paul McCartney, right? And
the story?
The story was this. Okay, so I would go and stay at Lauren's house for a month or so out in the Hamptons during the summer.
Yeah.
And sometimes Dana would come, but it was mostly me and my really good friend Joe Forrestal, who's Lauren's ex.
I know Joe, yeah.
We would go out there and be basically Lauren's houseboys. Lauren would produce these dinners, and it'd be Diane Sawyer and Mick Jagger, and we'd all be sitting at the dinner table, and Lauren at the head of the table. And he probably couldn't even find a plate in his own house.
Right.
Me and Joe would do, we could do shopping, and we'd run, Lauren's a producer by instinct.
Yeah.
He would produce it.
Yeah.
You know, he'd have people like me. Anyway, I love Lauren for that. He's an instinctive producer.
Yeah.
So he produced these dinners, and we're part of the staff. But yeah. Anyway, so I always had the good weed, still
yeah.
do.
Yeah.
And Paul McCartney's a pothead, as yeah. everyone knows. So he would come and stay with his wife's ancestral, you know, Hamptons place. I think they're out in Montauk, but or South Fork. But you know, the family that she's from, you know, the photographic family.
Yeah. Said, oh, Eastman.
Eastman.
Yeah.
That's right. So anyway, he can't travel with the weed. He gets here and he's like, oh, "Where's the weed?" Lauren goes, "Whitney's got the weed. Come on over." So Paul comes over, I give him the weed. Dana's not a big pothead, but Paul's in there smoking with someone else, I think. John Head, maybe. Anyway, one of Lauren's buddies. And I'm in the kitchen making some Italian potato salad for him or whatever.
Yeah.
And Dana was there too. And Paul, you can't understand, you got to understand how much he looks up to Paul McCartney.
Dana, yeah.
Oh, my God, that's yeah. his guy. So Paul says to him, "Hey, I just cut these... tracks, you know, I got the rough cut, you want to hear them?"
Yeah.
And Dana's like, "What?" You know, and so he puts it on, and I come in, and according to Dana, I said to him, well, anyway, I'll just tell you the story of what really happened. I come in, and just to fuck with Paul, I say to him, "Oh, this is great. Who is this, Christopher Cross?"
Yeah.
And the funniest fucking part about this is that a month later, I see Paul at the Yankees game with Lauren, and we're talking. I think Chevy Chase is there, and Paul comes up to me and goes, "Whitney, do I sound like Christopher Cross still?" It really got under his skin.
Yeah.
A month later, he's still thinking about it. Yeah. It made me laugh so hard.
Yeah.
Made me laugh so hard. Anyway, that so, but when Dana told you that story, he made it sound really mean.
Oh.
Because he, instead of saying who I said, Christopher Cross, by the way, he's now a friend of mine, so I told him that story. He thought it was hilarious.
Yeah.
He's a great guy too, Chris Cross. But Dana said that I said, "Who is this Julian Lennon or Sean Lennon?"
Yeah.
And that would have been really mean.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And so I want to correct that record. That's not who I said. I said Christopher Cross, and that's funny.
Christopher Cross, "I'm going to run."
Yeah, the Yacht Rock.
Yeah.
You know, he's great. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that, and it actually did kind of sound like him, but but to say it was John Lennon's son would have just been cruel.
Yeah,
I would
of course,
never have done that.
Of course.
I mean, that's not ball busting. That's like just being mean.
Yeah. Oh, good. Well, I'm glad we straightened that out.
So I wanted to straighten that out. You know, it was all in fun. And that, oh, man, that day at the ball game when Paul said that, we had
that's
so much fun.
Funny.
Me and Joe decided to... Chevy was there, right?
Yeah.
And we're at the ball game, and Mike Tyson's sitting like six rows in front of us.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and he's being Mike Tyson, and everyone's coming and paying their tribute.
Yeah.
And Chevy's sitting like six rows up, and no one is paying attention to Chevy.
Yeah.
That's
never good.
Yeah. So he's getting more and more anxious about this. So finally, he gets up, and he walks down to Mike Tyson, where everyone's watching, turns around, makes sure everyone sees him, you know.
Yeah.
That's where all the attention is. Then he comes back and sits down. And Joe and I are like, "Oh, please, man, this." So what we did was we went up in the stands and we got a guy, a kid, like I think it was like an 8-year-old kid. I said, "We give you $5. I want you to go down there. You see Chevy Chase down there?" And it was Paul Simon, Chevy Chase, and Lauren sitting together. I said, "We want you to lean over Chevy and go, 'Hey, aren't you Lorne Michaels, creator of Saturday Night Live? Can I have your autograph?'" And totally ignore Chevy.
Yeah.
So the kid goes, "Hell yeah, I'll do it." So he goes down. And he does that.
Yeah.
Totally ignores Chevy. Yeah. And Lauren is like, "Oh, well, yes, I am," you know? So we got like, the perfect mix of people. We got a kid, we got an elderly person, we got a pretty girl. We got, and then we're going
you're,
to
you're, the, you're setting them all up to do that?
All of them,
yeah.
And then so Lauren had like three people come up and at the game who were all like, you know, just the people you'd want to come up.
Right? Yeah,
you want a kid, you want an old man, you want a pretty girl.
Yeah.
You know, we had a nice mix. And we kept doing that all day. We were like walking around. I can't remember what we were doing, but we were around town, right?
Yeah.
And we kept doing that all day. And just in tears. And then we realized, what the fuck? We can never tell anybody about this because if we did, now this is 30 years ago, how bad would that hurt Lauren?
Yeah.
You know, that would be a very cruel thing to have done to Lauren. It was originally a joke on Chevy, right. But it turned, when we got so deep into it, it was like, whoa, if anyone ever found out about this, Lauren would be very hurt.
Yeah.
So we buried it. But man, that was a fun day. We laughed so hard that day. Anyway, so that's the real story.
Okay.
Or just ball busting.
How did Lauren handle your drugs problems? Did
he? Lauren was, he handled it with a lot of compassion.
Yeah.
And Lauren is compassionate about letting people go. But, you know, he didn't really fire me. He just made it clear that, you know.
You got to get help?
That something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
But I remember something that Lauren told me at the time, you know, and I've never forgotten it. We were talking about drugs. I was doing them. In front of him, and he's like, I have mixed feelings about this. I don't know if I should let you do that.
Yeah.
And, you know, because he'd seen what happened to John.
Yeah.
And, I think he also knew people are going to do what they're going to do. And sometimes you got to do it to get the show done. But anyway, he said to me, if the white Anglo-Saxon Protestants controlled the drug trade, it would be in every household. And that is exactly what happened with Purdue Pharma. That's just what happened.
Yeah.
I've never forgotten it because it was so prophetic, you know.
Yeah.
He was right. When the corporate, he said corporate, you know, the corporate, if the corporate world, you know, was in the drug trade, it'd be in every house. That's what he said, the corporate world.
Interesting.
And it's exactly what happened.
Wow.
Yeah. Lauren, he has...
He's a smart guy. He's great.
Not only that, but his real talent, I think, or one of his many talents. I mean, you could stand next to him during dress rehearsal and listen to the notes he's giving and have a complete production education.
Yeah.
But one thing that he really understood was context.
Yeah.
He really has a knack for that.
Yeah.
You know, we had this sketch that was, I think it was a Downey sketch, about Hercules as a middle-aged man.
Yeah.
You know, trying to lift a rock. And and the main joke, of course, is the Italian dialogue turned into English, so his lips are... That's the main joke.
Oh, right.
But the other joke is Hercules, the return of Hercules, but he's like... And he's got a bad back, and all that. And it was would have been pretty funny, but Lauren just kept saying, no, don't do that. And then it was a trunk piece, you know? And then Bill Murray came back to host the show.
Yeah.
And the day he arrived, Lauren said, hey, get that Hercules sketch out. That's context.
Yeah.
You know? So now it's Bill Murray as Hercules coming back.
Right.
He got a bad back, his chops. Lauren really, that's context to me. That's taking something and making it mean more than it would by surrounding it.
Right.
Oh, that's great at that.
That's great.
Yeah. Yeah, I really admire that.
What was the journey after SNL?
Oh, yeah, I recovered. And I recovered and, one of the things they told me was that if you want to stay clean, I went to Hazelden.
Yeah.
And then they said, if you want to stay clean, you got to do all these things. You got to go to a meeting every day. You got to do this and do that and get a sponsor. So I did all those things. But one of the things they told me I had to do was to get therapy.
Yeah.
So I got the psychiatrist on 57th Street in Manhattan. A great psychiatrist, Mark Gerald, really amazing guy. And he was a professor at Columbia.
Yeah.
Really heavy dude. And he had me, you know, anyway, he was great. I learned a lot from him. You know what I learned from
him? He had you what?
I learned two things, that everything is intentional. That you do everything. Assume that is a very useful assumption.
Hmm.
Doesn't matter if it's true. If you assume that, you will start to understand why you do everything.
Right.
And that's the main thing I learned from him. So anyway, I'm walking out of his office one day, and I run into Jeff Stilson.
Yeah.
And Stilson goes, hey, Whitney Brown. He said, I got into comedy because I saw you at a comedy club up in Oregon.
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing. That's why I'm in comedy, because you like, oh, cool. I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm working at Comedy Central. Come on over. Then work there. We'll pay you scale. I'm like, sure, I'll go over there. And this was when they were really in a state of didn't know what they wanted to do. Was it the Ha Network?
Was it Comedy Channel or was it Comedy Central?
It was Comedy Central then, but it was half owned by Viacom.
Half by HBO.
And half by HBO,
yeah.
Time Warner. So both of them wanted to buy it, but neither would sell it.
Yeah.
You know, they would buy it for any amount, but wouldn't sell it at all. So they didn't know what they wanted to do. And we were just writing. It was terrible, the writer's room. They wanted to make it like a college dorm room. They were so lame. But anyway, we started writing interstitial programming for them. You know,
who was there? Was Gordetsky there?
Yes, Gordetsky was there. Liz Winstead, Madeline Smithberg.
Yeah.
Another girl, too. I'm trying to remember her name. I have her picture in my head. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to her. Stilson, a few others.
Yeah.
And through all these, we started writing interstitial programs, stuff to put in between their other programs. And then I think it was Madeline came up with this. Look, what we need is a flagship show. We need a flagship, like CBS has the CBS News.
Yes.
And so that's how The Daily Show came to
right.
be.
Right, with Kilborn.
With Kilborn, yeah. And so we, you know, sat there and figured it all out and launched the show.
You're on the original staff and creator of the Daily Show.
I probably hosted it 8 or 10 times.
Wow.
Kilborn was out for some
And how long did you stay sober?
I'm still sober.
No, I imagine you were real all clean for a while, right?
Yeah, all that time.
Yeah.
I was totally clean. But I was in huge trouble with the IRS. Robert Downey Jr. had recommended these accountants for me my first year.
Yeah.
And one of them was a crook. One of them is like really famous now. But he's a big, he's very wealthy and he's a big gay activist.
Yeah.
But anyway, in Hollywood. But one of them was a crook and he was, you know, stealing not that much money, a couple $1,000 here and there. But in order to cover it up, he fucked up my taxes so bad. That when I left Saturday Night Live, and I was didn't work for about a year or two while I was recovering.
Yeah,
I ended up owing them hundreds of thousands of dollars because I went from making a lot of money.
Yeah.
To making almost nothing.
Yeah.
And so the interest and penalties on my debt to them was going up way faster than the amount of money that I made.
Right.
It was going up more than I made.
Yeah.
And so that went on for like 7 or 8 years. I got checks from Comedy Central, and I hate doing paperwork, so yeah. I just couldn't deal with it. I just let them do whatever they wanted.
Yeah.
My checks were for $0 at Comedy Central.
Yeah.
100% withholding.
Wow.
And you know, I've always been able to make money other ways.
Yeah.
But it taught me something about working without... There's been some great art done by people who are not being paid.
Yeah.
Solzhenitsyn.
Yeah.
Kafka.
Yeah.
They lived in a country where the government took all of their money.
Yeah.
And yet they produced some really great stuff.
Right.
Why? You know, because I'd always just done it for the money. Why? And why did they do that when they weren't even getting paid?
Yeah.
And that was a very liberating...
Why? Because of purpose?
Because you can, and only you can.
Right.
If you don't do it, it won't be done.
Right. Yeah.
You know, if you don't make this thing that you know you can do, and this beautiful thing that you want to, that you know will be a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
If you don't do it, it won't exist.
Yeah.
And so you're driven to do it for that reason.
So that was a lesson.
A very big lesson, yeah. That things are worth doing. You know, you envision something, whether it's a whatever it is, a script or a show, act, and you see it, and you want it to exist, but you're the only one that can make it exist, and that's that drives.
So, did you re-engage with stand-up at that point, or no?
A little bit, but stand-up had changed a lot.
Yeah.
Back then, I remember going to do a show in after 9/11, and I had some jokes.
Yeah.
That. It was in Princeton. A lot of people had died from there. The guy said, you can't do those jokes. You know, they're not. It was just.
We're over at the Catch a Rising Star?
Yeah.
In Princeton?
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
No, we're at.
I think it was a catch. Maybe it was an improv. But anyway.
No, it was a catch.
The guy was like, you can't talk about 9/11. And I was talking about, you know, Arab racism that had come out of it.
Yeah.
Actually, that was my angle. And I said, well, listen, you can't tell me. It's your stage, but you can't tell me. But it's my act. You can't tell me what I can say or not. You can say I can't go on your stage.
Yeah.
But you can't tell me what I'm going to say when I go up there.
Yeah.
So he said, you can't go on my stage. Fair enough.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's a division that I don't think a lot of people understand. But anyway, that's what happened there. I had a few. Yeah, the whole comedy scene had changed.
Yeah, sure.
We used to make a lot of money, man. We used to make $5,000 a week. You know? But that all, you know.
So you're just kicking around doing writing projects and
disco
this and that?
Ended it all.
Yeah. Disco?
Yeah, I was, you know, I've always been able to make a living. Oh, you know what I did? I went, I had a motorcycle and I was riding a lot. And there was a little shop, a little tiny, almost like the size of a two-car garage, motorcycle shop. Went down to, you know, I needed some work done on my bike. Got to
in the city?
No, in Greenwich, Connecticut.
Okay.
In the working class part of Greenwich. So I went down there one day and I said, Carlos, this is my good friend Carlos Escudero, who still has a shop, by the way, a motorcycle shop in Greenwich, Solo Moto. I went down and I said, I want to be your intern. And so I started working for him. And he said, I don't know what, sort these carburetor jets out for me. So I started working for him. And after a little while, he started paying me. And then he started paying me more. And then, you know, I was kind of a sounding board for him. So we, you know, we put together a plan, got a much bigger shop, which he still has.
Yeah.
This was 30 years ago. And, you know, and I would work on bikes with him. And you know, people would say to me, oh, you know, how can you, you know, just be a motorcycle mechanic after being on Saturday Night Live? Well, like, you know, it doesn't seem as exciting, but I think that's ridiculous because not just that it's honest work, but the stakes. You know, if you don't write a good joke, people don't laugh. If you fuck up somebody's motorcycle, they can get killed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's life or death.
Yeah.
So the stakes are, it's a way more important job.
Sure.
You know, why we pay singers 1,000 times as much as we pay firemen, that's the mystery of our culture, but that's the way it is.
And how'd you get pulled into Air America? Because that's when
that's
when I kind of met you.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Who did pull me? I think
Liz.
It was Liz. Yeah, yeah, it was Liz. She's the one who hired me, and she's the one who fired me.
From Air America?
Yes.
Well, the whole thing went south.
Yeah, it was pretty bad.
Yeah.
But there was, I love Liz Winstead. She's very creative. Kind of the classic New York liberal.
Sure. And then when did you move here?
Yeah. Well, I used to do this thing where I would say, what if you could close your eyes? And then when you opened them, you would see what your eyes are going to see 10 years from now. You know, just a glimpse.
Yeah.
What would it be? You know, would you see anything? And I did that and I realized that nothing interesting was going to come out of the life I was living. So I packed up everything, put all my bills on automatic and everything. So I was all ready to go. And Nesmith, Michael Nesmith, called me. We had been friends since the 80s. And he asked me, he had this thing called Video Ranch where it was like a, kind of like Second Life, but it was with music. And he was trying to get it going. And he asked me if I would DJ. I have many thousands of jazz albums.
Yeah.
So would I DJ a jazz program that's like a live show in this Video Ranch? And so
he was out here?
He was out here and I was in Connecticut.
Yeah.
The great thing about his situation, the screen thing was that you can chat about the music without interrupting the music.
Right.
And you always want to talk about the music, but it interrupts it. So by typing, you could. Anyway, I had fun doing that. I did it for a few months. And then he said, hey, I'm doing a show at this thing called South by Southwest in Austin, Texas. Would you come down? It's 5 days. I got 20 bands. So all the greatest bands in Austin, or some of them. Would you come down and MC it? I'm like, sure, I'll do that. Came down, and it was fun. There was some great bands, Texas Tornado. That's where I met Flaco Jimenez, met Ray Benson, met some great people. But I met my wife there.
Yeah.
I'm standing outside smoking. I see this pretty young girl carrying this giant red amp from her car. I'm like, shoot, that girl needs some help. And so we got to know each other a little bit, talked, and then she came to New York to work at Joe's Pub to do her show there. She, I think she had like a 5-piece band.
What was the name of the band?
Carolyn Wonderland.
It's always her name.
It's always her. That's Carolyn Wonderland.
And she's a guitar wizard.
She is a great songwriter, a great guitar player, a great musician, and a really great singer. She's in the Austin Music Awards Hall of Fame.
Great. And that, so you met her and that got you out here?
She just finished her 13th album.
Amazing.
For Alligator, which I really want you to hear some rough cuts after we're done with this.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's the best work I think she's ever done. Yeah, I love, and my wife said come to Texas. Oh, well, we hooked up in New York. She emailed
after Joe's
me.
Pub?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I came to her show, and then the rest is, it's just been beautiful.
Well, you got a beautiful place.
I wish I'd come to Texas sooner.
Yeah.
And, of course, the government's terrible, but the government here is not always and doesn't always have to be. Look, LBJ, the greatest president of my lifetime, came from right here in the Hill Country.
Yeah.
Molly Ivins, you know, Ann and Cecile Richards, Barbara Jordan. We have a legacy of great politicians, and we're going to get it back again. We will eventually.
I hope you're right, and I'll mark your words on that.
Yeah, in Texas, the people here are not as dumb as our government is.
Yeah,
I mean UT is one of the best educational systems in the world. MD Anderson. I mean, the microchip was invented here.
Yeah.
The microchip.
Yeah.
The integrated circuit was invented here.
Yeah.
We went to the moon from here.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we deserve better and we'll get it.
Great talking to you, man. Let's have some beans and rice.
Yes, my friend.
There you go. I wanted to mention again that Whitney's wife, Carolyn Wonderland, plays regularly in Austin and is also on tour. You can check out her gigs and more at carolynwonderland.com. Great guitar player. Hang out for a minute.
Manchmal willst du einfach nur ans Meer. Oder durch die Straßen einer lebendigen Stadt schlendern. Oder endlich den Moment genießen. Einfach die Welt mit TUI neu erleben. Mit TUI reist du so, wie du willst. Als Familie, zu zweit oder einfach allein. Flexibel, sicher und immer mit dem guten Gefühl, dass jemand da ist, wenn es drauf ankommt. Gestalte mit TUI Urlaub ganz nach deinen Wünschen. Überall im Reisebüro, auf tui.com und in der App.
Hi, Backmarket hier. Die mit der Technik, die sich perfekt verschenken lässt. Wie dieser Laptop. Er kann alles, was ein Laptop so kann. Zum Beispiel Black Friday Deals suchen, Preise vergleichen, nervige Werbung wegklicken und weitersuchen. Dabei ist der hier schon bis zu 40% günstiger. Denn er ist nicht neu. Er ist professionell erneuert. Das heißt, von Profis auf Herz und Nieren geprüft. Fitter Akku und 12 Monate Garantie inklusive. So, jetzt musst du nicht mehr suchen. Das richtige Geschenk. Abgesichert durch das Backmarket-Versprechen.
Hey folks, if you feel like going back into the WTF archives for some classics, it was 6 years ago tomorrow that we posted my talk with Josh Brolin. It's episode 915, and it's a good one. Love that guy.
How long have you been sober?
Almost 5 years.
That's great.
Yeah. But I had 5 years, and then I had 3.5.
That's what happens.
And then 5, and then,
Are you able to identify why you decide that moment?
To go back out?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, man. It was an absolutely fully conscious decision.
As you're like, you know, I'm ready?
Yeah. Seriously. It wasn't like, it wasn't like, you know, you hear these guys in the rooms, they're like, I don't even know what happened. Like, before I knew it, I was in the bar, I was drinking, I get all the fucking, I don't know what happened. And you're like, how's that possible? I knew, I made an absolute conscious decision to go fuck it up even more.
Yeah.
Because I appreciated the destructivity of it all.
Yeah, yeah.
More than I liked sobriety at that point.
Right.
Now, it's very different.
Yeah.
It's very different.
And what do you think changed?
I don't know. And there was no major, like, the moment of clarity or anything. Yeah. I saw my grandma. She was on her apparent deathbed. She didn't die until later.
Yeah.
And I went in there after Halloween, and I had been kind of helming the whole taking care of grandma thing, and the family was around and all that. And my brother and I were going to go see her, and this was like the 10th day or something.
Yeah.
And then I went out and to have a nice Halloween with my wife.
Yeah.
And then that turned into all kinds of shit. When you end up at Del Taco, you know something's wrong. You know what I mean?
If you know it's late, time to get sober.
If it's late at night, yeah.
Yeah.
Del Taco, not even paying attention to what's around you.
No.
Just like,
no. Eating. No, you see the sign kind of through a brownout or a blackout, and you're like, what does that say? Del? No. Taco. Fuck. And you know you're doomed.
That's available for free in all podcast apps and at WTFpod.com. And you can always get every episode of WTF ad-free by signing up for WTF Plus. Just go to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. And a reminder, this podcast is hosted by Acast. God, I just want to sneeze. Oh, I'll play guitar. Monkey and LaFonda, cat angels everywhere.